Now, time for us to catch up on stories making headlines around the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, we hear about the biggest street protests in Israel's history and a deal to provide Australia with nuclear-powered submarines in the face of China's growing influence. But first, we go to Turkey, where the pieces are now in place for the presidential and parliamentary elections. Observers have said that the polls will be the most significant test of public opinion in two decades. Jasper Mortimer reports now from the Turkish capital, Ankara.
Turkey's elections, the most exciting in 20 years, are taking shape. The date for the presidential and parliamentary polls has been promulgated, May the 14th. The opposition has agreed on a joint candidate to challenge Recep Tayyip Erdogan for the presidency. Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, a former finance ministry official and the leader of the largest opposition party. And the issues, what voters will be voting on, have become clear. The economy, the personality of the challenger, and the government's response to the earthquakes. On a deeper level, however, the elections will be a referendum on Erdogan's 20-year rule. And they're exciting because for the first time since his party came to power in November 2002, the opposition has a real chance of winning. But for liberal Turks, the elections are much more important than a race that is hard to predict. For liberals, if Erdogan wins, it will mean the people have endorsed all he has done to unravel human rights in Turkey. The suppression of the free press, political interference in the courts, the prosecution of dissidents on charges of insulting the president, and so on. If Erdogan wins, he'll be entitled to think that Turks want more of the same. As The Economist magazine warned in January, an Erdogan victory could push a deeply flawed democracy into a full-blown dictatorship. At the moment, things are looking good for the opposition. Last Monday, Reuters published a survey of four opinion polls that showed Kılıçdaroğlu would beat Erdogan, and it is said that the party which wins the presidency will come first in the parliament as well. But there are 8 weeks to go, and Erdogan remains a force to be reckoned with. He connects strongly to the working class in a country where people are tired of rule by the elite. He's also seen as a strong character in a crisis. If Kurdish militants were to detonate a bomb and kill people in the coming weeks, God forbid, that would frighten the electorate, and voters would swing behind Erdogan. However, Erdogan's handling of the economy and of the earthquakes have cost him support. Inflation is officially 55%, but official statistics are not trusted, and an independent think tank says inflation is actually 127%. Unemployment is just under 10%. When two earthquakes struck last month, the government performed well in some of the 10 provinces affected, but very poorly in others. In Adıyaman, for instance, the Natural Disaster Agency took 3 days to reach the city. A paramedic walked up to a TV reporter performing a live broadcast in the city, pulled the microphone towards herself, and accused the government of being responsible for the deaths of people who were heard calling for help from underneath the rubble during the first 2 days. The question is, how heavily will these factors weigh on people's minds when they vote? Turkish voters have notoriously short memories. The opposition has disadvantages. A major one is the character of Kılıçdaroğlu. A man of humble origins, he has the common touch, and nobody has ever questioned his integrity. Although good at asking pointed questions, he's regarded as mild-mannered. He cuts a gentle profile against the aggressive Erdogan. Kılıçdaroğlu is also Alevi, a subsect of Islam. Political analysts have warned that Erdogan is quite capable of holding that against him in the campaign. During the past year, polls have consistently found that either the mayor of Istanbul or of Ankara would beat Erdogan hands down. But only occasionally have the polls predicted Kılıçdaroğlu would oust the president. However, the alliance of six opposition parties have decided to make Kılıçdaroğlu their candidate. And in the weeks to come, Kılıçdaroğlu has to convince voters that a moderate person can still be a good president. This is Jasper Mortimer for World Report in Ankara.
Next, we go to Israel, where the biggest street protests in the country's history have taken place. Hundreds of thousands of people have been demonstrating against the government's plans to limit judicial powers. New reforms aim to give the elected government decisive influence over the choice of judges and to curb the ability of the Supreme Court to rule against the executive or to strike down legislation. From Tel Aviv, Hannah McCarthy reports.
A sea of blue and white Israeli flags float down the street of central Tel Aviv. Some people banged drums, others pushed prams. Some wore fancy dress for the Jewish holiday of Purim. And that night, Peter Pan and Tinkerbell were some of the 240,000 people who took to the streets. Across the country, Israelis were protesting sweeping changes that the current Israeli government hoped to pass this year. The so-called judicial reforms will weaken the powers of the Supreme Court, and many, but perhaps not enough, believe that the changes threaten Israel's status as a democratic state. The government that is now in power in Israel only sees Jewishness and Israel as a specific culture, says Ilay Benayan, holding a placard saying "Hit me Bibi one more time," a play on the nickname of the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the title of US pop star Britney Spears' breakout hit. The new Israeli government wants everyone to be Orthodox Jews and women to be baby-making factories, says Eli. Despite Netanyahu facing corruption charges, which he claims are part of a witch hunt, he succeeded in coming to power last year after forming a coalition of right-wing and far-right parties. 35-year-old Emanuel Spiegel wasn't surprised that the current government was elected the previous year. The trend was clear, but right-wing could mean lots of things. It could mean right-wing on economics or security. Nobody during the campaign had ever talked about these changes, so the trend was clear that we were going right, but not this kind of right. The legislation that Netanyahu's government hopes to pass would give Israel's parliament the power to overrule Supreme Court decisions with a simple majority and allow the government to nominate judges. Many on Israel's right resent the Supreme Court's past decisions on illegal settlements in the West Bank, which is Palestinian territory occupied by Israel under international law, as well as their decision in 2005 to withdraw Israeli settlers from the Gaza Strip. If passed, the judicial forms will free up the government to push ahead with curbing rights for women and LGBTQ people, annexing the West Bank and relaxing the rules of engagement for security forces. People here in Israel come from all over the world, says Eli. There are people with different cultures, different ideologies and different ways of life. And one of the things that protects the individual inside this big group called Israel is the Supreme Court. Within the sea of white and blue Israeli flags on the street, there is a small leftist enclave waving the black, red and green Palestinian flag, calling out chants and holding placards with slogans like "We supported an occupation and now we have a dictatorship." The pro-democracy rallies have been criticised by some groups who say Israel could never claim to be a democracy while it's occupying the West Bank. 20-year-old Sigal is wearing a knitted cap that features half an Israeli flag and half a Palestinian flag. She says it's not common for her peers to support Palestine. While she's speaking to me, a man holding an Israeli flag approaches her and shouts, "It's not about this," while pointing at the Palestinian flag she holds. Some people believe that Palestinians are a minority group that shouldn't be supported, says 18-year-old Eli Yovel. "I do think that we should stay focused on the Israeli issue, but I think there are many other issues that this reform is going to greatly affect. I walked with a pride flag for a few of the weeks of the protest, but this week I'm not. First, because I do think that it is more focused to walk with an Israeli flag, but mostly because I didn't feel safe walking with the pride flag or with the Palestinian flag. The protests have become bigger," she says, "but also gradually more violent. 2 weeks ago, on the way back from a protest, Ellie and two of her friends were hit by stones by a group saying that she didn't deserve to hold the Israeli flag as a leftist. I have some family that are against the protest," she says, and adds that they're strong supporters of Netanyahu, who they believe is innocent of the corruption charges. They believe that the judicial reforms will make Israel more democratic, as the parliament who people vote for will make all the decisions, rather than a Supreme Court that we didn't choose, Eli says. Of course, the reforms will conveniently make it easier for Netanyahu to evade prosecution for the pending corruption charges. Eli says she tries not to discuss the topic at family gatherings. It just brings unwanted attention. For World Report in Tel Aviv, I'm Hannah McCarthy.
Finally, we go to Australia, and this week that country announced details of the most important security accord for decades after a meeting of the leaders of the trilateral AUKUS pact in San Diego. The accord with the United States and Britain will give Australia access for the first time to nuclear-powered submarines and become only the seventh country to operate them. The agreement could cost Australia up to $244 billion. It's widely seen as a counter to China's growing influence in the Indo-Pacific region. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Singapore's founding Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew warned that Australia was in danger of becoming the white trash of Asia. That was in 1980, but much has changed since then. Australia is now one of the most culturally diverse places on Earth. More migrants come from India and China than the United Kingdom. Australia's economy is embedded with those of its regional partners, especially China. Its demand for natural resources, especially iron ore, the key ingredient in steel making, has helped to make this country rich. China accounts for about a third of its global commerce. It's worth more than Australia's combined trade with Japan, the United States and South Korea, its next three biggest trading partners. But Canberra's diplomatic relations with Beijing have been strained in recent years over various political and trade disputes. This week they took another blow after Australia announced plans to buy and build nuclear-powered submarines armed with conventional weapons under a security accord with the US and UK. China's increasing assertiveness is a key reason behind the AUKUS pact. But Beijing has accused Washington, London and Canberra of a Cold War mentality. It insisted that the alliance was embarking on a path of error and danger. China's foreign ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said the AUKUS partners had, for the sake of their own geopolitical interests, completely disregarded the concerns of the international community. But the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said his government's ambition of greater military cooperation with the United States and closer economic ties with China was not a contradictory position. Mr. Albanese believes he can have it both ways, that Australia can feel safe and secure under the watch of the US, but also prosperous because of trade with China. Delicate diplomacy is required. Since his centre-left government came to power last May, the Prime Minister has made repairing the relationship with China a priority. Last November, Mr. Albanese met with the Chinese President Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the G20 International Summit on the Indonesian island of Bali. It was the first time an Australian leader had held formal talks with the Chinese President since 2016. But these remain unpredictable times, according to the former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. He's warned of an accidental war between the United States and China. Earlier this month, the Chinese Foreign Minister Qin Gang said that if the US didn't change what he called its policy of suppression and containment of China, there would surely be conflict and confrontation. Mr. Rudd said these alarming comments were meant for a domestic audience from a senior member of the Chinese Communist Party who was seeking to divert blame for China's economic woes. At stake in the Indo-Pacific region are stability and peace. Trust, however, between its major players appears to be in short supply. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.